Transportation Committee will come to order. Welcome, everybody. I'm going to have to leave early, and so I wanted to take care of the work session first. And with that, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 129. Patrick.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 129 is the measure that increases the penalty for violation of ODOT out-of-service orders. The bill is designed to bring Oregon into compliance with federal rules related to commercial driver licenses. We heard this bill first on May 4th, and you have materials in your packet.
All right. Committee, when we heard this bill, the Farm Bureau and the Nursery Association raised a couple concerns. We did check in with LC, and the department's reading of the bill was that they would have to be driving a commercial motor vehicle. And if I'm remembering right, this is what the concern was over, whether or not if they were in their personal vehicle and got cited, that it would affect their commercial, but they actually have to be driving a commercial vehicle for this to count on their commercial license. So, and Patrick, if you're have any clarification, because I'm
Madam Chair, members, the issue was the subsection 2 of the bill, I believe, stipulates that that the department can cancel or refuse to renew, I believe it's cancel or refuse to issue a commercial or a farm endorsement on a Class C license in the event that a person violates any two or more of any of the category of list of violations that disqualify a person for holding a commercial driver license. The one issue that was discussed, I believe, in particular was the fact that for a commercial license, a person who's pulled over while operating a commercial vehicle and holding a commercial license, the maximum blood alcohol content for them is 0.04. If they blow over a 0.04, they're in violation compared to a Class C, which is a 0.08. And that was the primary issue of concern. The measure, as written, as you said, would apply if a person with a Class C license and a farm endorsement is pulled over, blows between a 0.04 and 0.07, they would be subject to the same requirements as the commercial license, and that would be considered a violation. Two of those violations disqualifies you from holding a commercial license, and according to this bill, would disqualify you from holding a Class C license with the farm endorsement. And I believe Tom McClellan from DMV could explain it in more detail and probably much more eloquently than I just did.
All right. And we do have, it's my intent to move the bill as it is. We do have a letter from Jeff Stone of the Oregon Nurseries Association laying out their concerns and about unintended consequences. And you have that in front of you. So with that.
Are you looking for a motion, yeah. Madam Chair?
I'll wait for a motion.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 129A to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Call has moved Senate Bill 129A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Yes, Representative Boone.
Thanks, Chair Beyer. In the OEN letter, they talk about staying silent on Section 8. I'm sorry, I don't have my bill in front of me. It says it clearly has immigration-related impacts may be ultimately refuted as the Real ID Act is reexamined in Congress. And not only that, but didn't we just pass a bill out of here last week or earlier this week about on the Real ID?
Yesterday, 2 days ago.
Yeah, a couple days ago. So how? I guess my question is, how would that affect this section of the bill?
Mr. McClellan, you want to...
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom McClellan, DMV Administrator with the Department of Transportation. Representative Boone, Section 8 deals with hazardous materials, hazmat endorsements. It's a requirement of the Transportation and Safety Administration. It's a TSA requirement that has been in place for several years. Is not related to the Real ID Act.
Okay.
That's the answer you want to hear.
Thanks.
Representative Berger.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I had hoped that the folks involved with this would come to terms with some of the issues here that have been raised by the farm folks. I'm really deeply disappointed that the evidence of the, by this letter that it casts a wide net and will crudely apply to all farm-endorsed license holders. And there's a fear of unintended consequences for farm folks in this and confusion over the 04 and 08. I appreciate that you're moving it, but it'll probably be without my support. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just to refresh my memory, had we taken any action on the
No.
ACE that we had not?
No.
Thank you.
And Gilman. Yeah. Representative Gilman.
Thank you.
Yes. Sorry.
I don't think this bill, I think the relating clause, the bill wraps too much stuff into the bill that's not related, and that's the farm endorsement. Furthermore, I don't think farmers should have to have the .04 requirement when the general public is .08. I'll be a no.
Thank you. Any other comments? I want to be clear here. In the .04 only applies when they are driving a commercial motor vehicle. And it's clear to me that that is the way the statute is written. The if they have a Class C and a farm endorsement and they're driving their personal car, a .04 does not affect them. It has to be a .08. So in my mind, we need to remember that if these people are driving under the influence, whether it's .04 or .08, for one thing. And I think that if they're at .04 and they're driving a big commercial vehicle, I don't think that's acceptable any more than I think driving a personal vehicle at .08 is acceptable. So with that, this is the reason that I support this bill. Representative Schaffler.
Just so I get it right, Madam Chair. If they have a commercial driver's license and a farm endorsement, they're driving their personal car or pickup, and they blow a .04, they're down the road. But if they're driving a commercial vehicle and they blow an 04, then they lose their commercial driver's license endorsement and their farm endorsement.
No, I don't think that's exactly accurate. It's a Class C farm with a farm endorsement allows them to drive a big truck with.
Forgive me.
And a lot of them are commercial, but this only applies to the Class C with a farm endorsement.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
The other thing, Representative, I would add is that there are two violations are required before you would lose your license, I believe. It's on the second violation, not the first.
Thank you.
Any other comments? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bailey?
Aye.
Representative Bent?
No.
Representative Berger?
No.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative Edwards?
Aye.
Representative Schaffler?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Representative Gilman?
No.
Representative Call?
Aye.
Chair Beyer?
Aye. The motion passes.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I gave it an aye vote here because I need to look into it more, but, I mean, people should not be driving a big rig if they are under the influence of alcohol, and that's why I voted yes here, but I'm looking into the bill a lot deeper and may change possibly on the floor, but I haven't seen anything that raises my level where it's going to hurt farmers at all with where things are at right now. So.
Thank you. I guess I can go ahead and carry this bill. So the work session on Senate Bill 170 is closed.
129.
I'm out of order here. Senate Bill 129 is closed. Thank you. And I'm going to go ahead and open a public hearing on SJR 8. Representative Metzger. Senator Metzger, I'm sorry.
He gave me Senate Bill 8.
You can call him General.
General.
Want me to speak for Patrick? I don't know.
Patrick.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. SDR 8 designates the airstrip at the Aurora State Airport as West La Mata Field at Aurora State Airport.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26. I'll be brief because you'll get more information from a few esteemed folks in the audience. SDR 8, as Mr. Brennan pointed out, designates the airstrip at Aurora State Airport as West La Mata Field, and it is only fitting and right that should had happened. As you will hear, and many of you already know, Mr. La Mata has been a pioneer in aviation in the state of Oregon. His company, Columbia Helicopters, based in Aurora, is the largest heavy lift helicopter company in the world, provides hundreds and hundreds of jobs, and the innovation, as you will hear, has been amazing. He essentially pioneered a heavy lift helicopter loggings to be environmentally sensitive, so a light touch on the ground. They have been involved in many heavy lift operations across the world. His reputation of his company has been so profound that now our National Guard and other National Guards are bringing their helicopters to Columbia for servicing. And this is a story that goes back some 40 years that you'll hear about, Mr. La Mata. And he has really made not only aviation, the helicopter industry in this country, but he certainly has put Aurora on the map and it continued to grow and be a major source of very proud employees and justifiably so with a very proud company.
Hey, no problem.
You'll also hear Mr. La Mata, because he will not talk about this, has been a major philanthropist, and you'll probably hear about some of that with children and abuse. Women and children and helping in cancer with the Providence Health System that he does very, very quietly out of the goodness of his heart. And this is only fitting. This has the support of the Department of Aviation and a unanimous vote out of the Oregon State Senate. So with that, I will go back and do more of your bills unless anybody has any questions.
Anybody have any questions for the good senator?
Thank you.
None? Thank you. Okay. Dan Klim. I was going by order. If you have an order, you would prefer here.
I would. I'd like to defer to the family to make their presentation.
Yes. Thank you. All right. So. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman Beyer and members of the committee. My name is Ken Callahan. I am the training program administrator for Columbia Helicopters, and I've been with the company a little over 20 years. And I'd like to share with you this afternoon some things about this proposal, as well as to register my support of Oregon State Senate Joint Resolution 8 to designate the airstrip at Aurora State Airport as West La Mata Field at Aurora State Airport. Please let me tell you a little bit about West La Mata and his company. Wes was working as a longshoreman and truck driver in the 1950s when he heard that there was a need for helicopter pilots. He used his World War II GI benefits to learn to fly helicopters from another Oregon aviation pioneer, Dean Johnson. In April 1957, he convinced his brother Ed to finance his first helicopter. He named his company Columbia Helicopters, which was a plural name despite having only one helicopter at the time. Eventually, all four of the LaMotta brothers were actively involved with the Wes's company. Wes's early days involved selling rides at county fairs and from street corners on weekends. Wes's brothers helped out selling tickets and refueling the aircraft. To Wes, promoting the work of a helicopter was a method of promoting the future. In September of 1957, Wes and his aircraft were involved in what has been called the Oregon Coast's greatest rescue that no one seems to know about anymore. And that was, he was flying a colonel from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers near Coos Bay, Oregon, when they noticed that one of the Corps' dredges had suffered a collision with a freighter and was sinking with men still on board. Wes made repeated trips back and forth to the ship, encouraging sailors to climb onto the skid of the helicopter. Wes rescued 15 sailors that day, a record for single-handed life-saving at the time. His photo of himself and his aircraft appeared in Life magazine. Wes was awarded the Army Air Medal for the rescue and used the publicity from his rescue efforts to help his company continue to grow. He continued to do anything he could to promote helicopter operations, including selling rides, carrying reporters, carrying even circus acts, teaching others to fly. In 1959, Wes and his brothers flew passengers at the Oregon Centennial in Portland, and a five-minute ride cost $3.50. In 1960, Wes made another significant contribution to the helicopter industry. In the early use of construction with helicopters, it involved men on the ground radioing instructions to the pilot who could not see the load. Wes believed that there was a better method and switched to a seat inside the aircraft that had a second seat or a second set of flight controls at the co-pilot seat. This allowed him to look directly down on his load and see how it needed to be flown and for precision placement of the load. The first test of this system involved setting power poles and stringing wire in the Columbia River Gorge near the Dalles Dam. Direct Visual Operational Control, or DVOC, is now an industry standard. In 1962, Wes moved his company to the brand new Portland heliport on Swan Island. Wes filled it with a variety of aircraft as his company continued to grow. And then he also began to sell helicopters. Wes had always been interested in the external load applications of helicopters. However, he needed bigger aircraft with a higher lifting capacity necessary for the work that he intended to do. He created the heavy lift helicopter industry when he bought a Sikorsky S-61, his first large helicopter in 1967. He used it for installing large power line tower systems, and he also developed one of the first effective methods of using a helicopter to fight forest fires. In 1969, Wes bought the first three tandem rotor helicopters for his company. These aircraft were the first of what would eventually become the largest privately held fleet of heavy lift helicopters anywhere in the world, a fleet exceeded by only some of the world's militaries. Also in 1969, Wes pioneered the concept of a successful helicopter logging in southern Oregon. He had examined the process early in the 1960s, but again felt that he needed big helicopters for big trees. In part because Wes developed helicopter logging in Oregon, other similar companies soon followed Wes's path. Today, Oregon is home to several of the largest heavy helicopter companies in the world. In 1976, when this picture was taken, Columbia Helicopters outgrew the Portland heliport at Swan Island and moved the company to its present location at the Aurora State Airport. Today, the company that Wes started with a single small helicopter in Gresham, Oregon, is now the world leader in heavy lift helicopter operations. Currently, we have aircraft in the United States, Canada, Peru, Papua New Guinea, and Mexico. Previously, we've had aircraft in the Sudan, Saudi Arabia, Ecuador, Chile, Malaysia, Laos, New Zealand, and Australia, Burma, and Indonesia. Truly, we have become a global company. Today, as you see in the picture, the company's headquarters are also the site of Columbia's world-class maintenance facility. In addition to working on their own aircraft, Wes's company also works on military aircraft and components, as well as routine maintenance for non-military customers. Wes's company now boasts over 700 employees around the world. There are over 350 employees at Aurora. Most are highly skilled, and we are the largest single employer on the airport. Wes's company has generated in excess of $100 million for many years, also creates over $40 million in annual payroll, much of which flows to the state of Oregon. Columbia Helicopters has always and always will be an Oregon-based company. This year, as we celebrate Oregon's 150th birthday, I feel that it's important that we recognize that there are still pioneers among us whose contributions are as significant to the state today as those who helped to establish our state a century and a half ago. Wes LaMotta is one of those pioneers, and I ask that you, as a committee, support Senate Measure, Joint Measure 8, to honor his contributions to his pioneering vision. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Schaffer.
Thank you. Several years ago, I was, I think Representative Gilman might have been there. I was on the Ag and Natural Resources Interim Committee, and one of your representatives was at the meeting talking about how had they had the management system not broken down at the federal level, that one of your helicopters was right next to one of those, what turned out to be a 2-million-acre fire.
Catastrophic fire.
And they could have just dealt with it. But because of bureaucracy, they couldn't. I really appreciate what this family's done, and Mr. LaMotta, I wish that I wish you were in the forest and working more. I wish you had more to do in Oregon, not just state, but definitely federal land. So, but when we do get back on the federal land, I'm confident you'll be prepared to help those good working families and businesses get out there and yard out all the logs and all that good stuff. So,
thank you.
Good resolution here, and I appreciate you bringing it forward. It's really a nice book. I can't wait to read it.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My brother-in-law worked for your company for many years and ran one of your helicopter shows for a while, and I had the privilege of going out and watching. It was a very astounding operation. I'm joined Representative Schaffler and wishing that there was more activity in the Northwest, because you certainly developed a interesting means of bringing timber out, and great fun to watch.
Thank you.
It is.
Here's one thing to point out, too. We've recently, I guess over the last probably 8 to 10 years, have become more of a heavy lift global aviation company. I mean, logging is still probably 50 to 55% of our business. When I started the company 20 years ago, it was 85%. So you can see the diversification now in some of the things that we've talked about in military service and some of the other things we do. So we're working to become more and more diversified to meet our global challenges.
Okay, go ahead.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Dick Clark. I'm Executive Director of the Providence St. Vincent Medical Foundation and immediate past president of Downtown Rotary. I want to be conscious of your time, so I'll summarize my comments that have been distributed to you, if that's your pleasure.
It's up to you. I am going to have to leave in about 10 minutes, but the rest of the committee will be here, so and they have time.
I'll still abbreviate them, and then you can read the further comments at your leisure. Likewise, it's my honor to represent the LaMotta family today, and Wes LaMotta in particular, in his consistent leadership role in making a difference in the lives of residents of Oregon and Southwest Washington. I think, simply stated, Wes LaMotta is a citizen of our community who hears about the needs of others and responds generously. He doesn't offer his philanthropic support because he wants public attention. In fact, he shies away from it. He doesn't seek financial benefit or political favor. I just would like to summarize a couple of the institutions that he has benefited in Oregon and Southwest Washington. His philanthropy is diverse, and it touches a lot of lives, and he does it quietly and without fanfare. For example, Wes and his wife Nancy have supported a local children's hospital, providing medical care for babies with brain tumors. The LaMottas have endowed a professorship at Oregon State University School of Forestry, and they provide scholarships to deserving students there. In the Portland area, they have supported a domestic violence shelter for homeless women and children, and they also support another nonprofit that serves the emotionally distressed. They also offer support in the Pendleton community and support outreach for mentally disabled children in that area. Their giving is also very personal. See, Wes is a 5-time cancer survivor, and he lost one of his daughters to cancer in 2005. To that end, he would like to help that cause and help others that suffer from it. They've provided generous support for cancer research, both locally and nationally. He also understands the importance of training and providing leadership for the next generation. They've sponsored a LaMotta family, Wes and Nancy, a program called I Have a Dream in Southwest Washington. They started that support in 1997. And as sponsors with four other couples, they've funded the work to provide a class of 75 local fourth graders with counselors. And these are kids that are at risk. Because the support started in 1997, those kids have graduated from high school and are going on to college, and the LaMottas continue their support now for those kids. That's really what Wes does. He finds needs, and he provides dreams that come true. And he is generous, very generous. He responds. So thank you for your consideration of this this bill today, and the rest of my testimony includes other examples.
Thank you.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I'll also abbreviate my testimony as well. I'd first like to thank all of you for the opportunity to speak before you here today. My name is Mark Gibson. I'm General Manager of Aircraft Operations at Timberland Logging, one of a large number of helicopter companies based in the state of Oregon. I'm also President of Siskiyou Transportation, both operations based in Ashland, Oregon. I serve as Chairman of the Board of the Oregon Trucking Association, as well as Vice Chairman of the Helicopter Association International, which is a worldwide trade association representing helicopter operators, manufacturers, and other supporting entities worldwide. It is indeed an honor to testify in support of this resolution. Throughout my years in the helicopter industry, the trucking industry, and the timber industry, I have always personally looked up to Columbia Helicopters and Wes. Wes LaMotta and Columbia Helicopters are a prime example of the American ingenuity and determination that have made this country great. From humble beginnings in 1957 to their current standing as the largest heavy lift helicopter company in the world, Wes LaMotta and Columbia Helicopters have always been at the forefront of the industry through innovation, professionalism, and ingenuity. The helicopter vertical lift industry owes credit to Mr. LaMotta and Columbia for many industry contributions. One of the first and arguably one of the most important is that of the direct visual operational control technique used to perform external load operations suspended from a long line attached to the bottom of the helicopter. This technique was first developed by Wes in 1960 and later became key in Columbia's first proving the feasibility of helicopter logging operations in 1971 and subsequently their pioneering of oil rig movements. Power line and ski lift construction, rooftop placement of construction equipment, the first to fly linemen hovering over energized power lines in an external basket, firefighting, and any of the endless functions performed today by the helicopter aerial crane industry. Columbia Helicopters' achievements don't end with external load milestones. In 1985, Columbia flew three BV-107 helicopters for 100 days straight in support of disaster assistance and famine relief in Sudan, helping to deliver millions of pounds of food and medicine. Columbia Helicopters has achieved countless milestones in terms of numbers of hours flown in twin rotor helicopters. In 1988, Columbia Helicopters modified the Boeing 234 Chinook helicopter, allowing it the ability to be the only helicopter capable of lifting and transporting 125% of its own weight. Wes LaMotta and Columbia Helicopters have received numerous industry awards, including Wes's receiving the American Helicopter Society's Captain William J. Kostler Award for two consecutive years, which recognizes the greatest achievements in the practical application or operation of the helicopter. In 1995, Wes received the Pathfinder Award, given by the Boeing Museum of Flight in Seattle. The award recognizes those individuals who have made significant contributions to flight in the northwestern part of the United States. Wes LaMotta received HAI's Lawrence D. Bell Memorial Award for helicopter management leadership, as well as being awarded HAI's Honorary Life Membership Award. In addition to Mr. LaMotta's awards, Columbia Helicopters and numerous employees have received several of the Helicopter Association International's awards through HAI's annual Salute to Excellence Award ceremony. I could go on with the many contributions, some acknowledged and some not, that Mr. Wes LaMotta and Columbia Helicopters have made to the industry as well as the community. I urge your support and subsequent passage of SJR 8 in going a short distance and helping to recognize those many contributions through the simple renaming of the Aurora State Airport. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Seeing none, I was instructed that I am supposed to give you a hard time while you're up here today. and given that, I assume you are probably looking for a new director for your organization, right?
And I know you couldn't do that.
So. Well, thank you for coming and testifying. I do have Dan Klim down, but I also want to take this opportunity to introduce Marcy LaManna Walsh, who is chosen not to speak, but is sitting in the audience, and the daughter. And we're really happy to have you here, and thank you for sharing your dad with the state. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the House Committee on Transportation. My name is Dan Klim, Director of Oregon Department of Aviation, also the airport sponsor for the Aurora State Airport. The department supports Senate Joint Resolution 8. The renaming will not affect the flight directories, so there won't be a cost. And at such time as new signs are programmed for the airport, we'll conduct the fundraising necessary to add the West LaManna Field to the airport. So, also as a retired Corps of Engineer Army officer, I can tell you that to sling load a pallet of food supplies on a standard 8x8 pallet requires a 2,000-pound cargo net, and it requires a 57 chain link count. As I conducted sling load operations in the Army and taught them, I learned a lot about sling load operations the Army did and the support that it provides worldwide due to the pioneering efforts and the science that Wes LaManna and his staff put together to really make the Army sling load operations what they are today, as well as all the surfaces. So I personally was a benefactor of the pioneering that he did, so wanted to offer that perspective. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing them, we appreciate your coming today. I'm going to close the public hearing on JR8 and open a work session on Senate Bill or SJR8. Yes, Representative Call.
Madam Chair, I move SJR8 to the floor with a due be adopted resolution. Yeah, recommendation. Thank you.
Representative Call has moved that SJR8 be moved to the. Move to the floor with a do adopt recommendation.
Thank you.
Discussion? Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to thank the family and the company representatives for these wonderful books. I'm going to hopefully find my dad in one of these pictures.
No other comments? Is Mike, Representative Schaffler outside before? Okay. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bailey?
Aye.
Representative Benn?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative Edwards?
Aye.
Representative Schaffler?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Representative Gilman?
Aye.
Representative Call?
Aye.
Chair Meyer?
Aye. The motion passes. And do we have a carrier? Representative Widener. Thank you. And I'm closing the work session on SJR 8. And with that, I'm going to turn the gavel over to Representative Call.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, do we have people to testify on these? Which one? 170 or 171?
Either one.
We're ready for both. Mr. Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With that, I open a public hearing on Senate Bill 171.
Oh, yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 171 prohibits the construction of objects or structures that are physical hazards to air navigation, designates the Department of Aviation in coordination with local land use jurisdictions as responsible for determining what constitutes an air navigation hazard. It allows exceptions for cell phone towers and for persons who have received or applied for approval from the Federal Aviation Administration on or before the measure's effective date, which would be January 1st, 2010. The measure also authorizes the Director of the Department of Aviation to establish standards for mitigating air navigation hazards, and it requires airports to take actions to mitigate the hazards to air navigation. In your packets, Mr. Chair, members, you have the Dash 8 Amendment. That amendment specifies that the prohibition against construction that also applies if they've applied or received permission from FAA also applies if they have received same from the Energy Facility Siting Council.
That's great. And we have public testimony, so I'll just go on. Yeah, I'll go in order here. Dan Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the House Committee on Transportation. Again, my name is Dan Clem, Director of Oregon Department of Aviation. The department has brought this bill forward because growth and development and airspace are hitting each other. Tall structures specifically, this is what we call, in short version, is the tall structure bill. States of Washington, California have similar state law that allows the Department of Aviation to try to mitigate the hazards posed by when tall structures penetrate the air surfaces for flight patterns and so forth. Oregon is a through-the-fence state with three airports in the current pilot program to use the airports to promote economic development. And as of course, growth and development may or may not occur in and around the airport. With that, sometimes structures are more economical, more efficient if they're built vertically. And in fact, vertical structures pose a problem for particularly small aircraft. In current Oregon revised statute, the director of the Department of Aviation has the authority to determine marking and lighting requirements, but has no ability to intercede or have any effort to mitigate the hazard, because this is really solely between the FAA and the applicant. The Oregon State Aviation Department plays no role, or states of Washington, California do. Where they have an ability to mitigate, they're able to prevent conflicts of tall structures and airspace from running into each other. This bill would make it clear that it is not legal to construct something that's within the aviation surfaces, what we call the Part 77 surfaces. It would allow ODA the ability to mitigate the construction of those tall structures, and really would allow the state of Oregon to have an ability to intervene on behalf of the airport or the applicant with regard to any FAA determinations of a hazard. It excludes cell phone towers because the regulation involving cell phone towers is pretty intense and already takes into account mitigative measures involving airspace. And also the Dash 8 Amendment allows that the Department of Aviation would honor any decisions made by the FAA or the Energy Facility Siting Council. The bill also adds the ability for FAA or ODA, the Oregon Department of Aviation, to be notified whenever an Energy Facility Siting Council decision is pending, so that we'd have a chance to comment. Right now in state law, we're not one of the called out agencies, and we really, quite frankly, a lot of time don't know that there are applications. So we would ask that you would consider moving this bill. If I can answer any other questions, Mr. Chair.
Any questions? Representative Boone?
Thank you. I think you answered my question. I always want to call you Brian. You get that all the time, right? My question was around an energy structure, such as a windmill or something like that. Which are probably regulated under energy siting. But so if there's a wind farm going in, for example, then they would they don't have to let the FAA know now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, they do have to let the FAA know. They file an FAA Form 7460. And currently the problem I have at Wasco State Airport
the only airport in Sherman County, is that there are some proposed structures, wind towers to be built. That's the kind of green energy that this body and the governor have and people of Oregon have been talking about wanting. And they're in abeyance right now simply because of where they're sited. The FAA has not been willing to enter into discussions about mitigating that. Had we been involved, I'd like to say I think we could have helped that situation. So it is a real problem.
Thanks. Yes, Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Clem, Dan, what's the dash A8 amendment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, the 171-A8 amendment was referred to, I believe, earlier, and what it does is it removes the honor before from the bill, which means that any time an application is submitted or an approval has been given. So it removes the sort of the grandfather aspect of the bill, and then it also adds that the Energy Facility and Siting Council, if they've approved something, that it's exempt from this bill.
And you're in favor of this?
I am in favor. I'm sorry. Changes. Yeah,
yeah. There are two proponents of that kind of talk as well.
Okay. I just want to make sure.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In reading the bill, it says that a person may not construct an object or structure that constitutes a physical hazard to air navigation as determined by the department. So there must be rules, standards, something that folks could look at before they have to come to the department to ask. So have you already developed those rules, and if so, where do people look?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, each airport has a different airspace management plan. There are aeronautical charts that would show the minimum altitudes, but and if you constructed a wind tower nearby Wasco State Airport and it retained a top altitude of 414 feet, you might believe that that's safe with a flight pattern at 1,000 feet. Well, the FAA has determined that that isn't. So there are standards that are established for flight patterns, but again, anything within 1,000 feet of that airport it requires the FAA approval, and the problem herein is they didn't find out until after they had already, the energy company had already invested some money, that in fact they were told that it was a hazard. So the hazard determination in many cases is not clear, and quite frankly, if we have the ability to sort of predetermine that, Representative Bentz, then we remove the mystery from that.
Yes, I understand that. I'm just trying to figure out how people could know and where they look to know what it is they aren't supposed to be doing, because this, I think, is here to so that you have the power, the department has the power to make them move it after they built it. I want to know what they look at first before they build it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, the aeronautical charts, the Jepson charts, will give a clear picture of glide path and minimum altitudes. That's the first place to start. The problem is that the FAA's standards are posted on their website, and not all constructors of a tall object may refer to those before they start construction or start investment. So I will tell you that those standards are posted in the FAA minimum standards guidelines, and I also post them with regard to my diagrams, aeronautical charts for all of our airports.
Follow up.
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This doesn't really say that. It says a person may not construct an object or structure that constitutes a hazard as determined by the Oregon Department of Aviation. It doesn't really refer to those charts. So you must have administrative rules or something that folks can look at if they are building near an airport. Is that what they would do?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, I have minimum standards for each of the airports, and those are posted in an administrative rule.
Thank you.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. Wouldn't they have a radius around the airport at the local building code department that would trigger, hey, here you have these extra standards and rules and regulations. If you're going to build anything, you need to examine and make sure you're in compliance, wouldn't it? Just to avoid this, we didn't know and we built this structure and we're out of compliance. Doesn't that exist?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, many jurisdictions have those standards, many do not.
Oh.
Particularly in the structure of counties, they're not used to seeing tall structures other than agricultural ones or cell phone towers. So again, the wind tower issue has sort of brought this to the forefront. But again, many of them do not incorporate an airport overlay or imaginary services overlays in their local land use planning codes or comprehensive plans.
Let me follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
Just one more example with the state government working to help our local governments carry out their mission for the safety, health, and welfare of this community.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, I sure hope that's viewed that way.
Representative Vince, did you have another question?
I did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The towers that have gone up near North Powder, the wind towers that have gone up out there, close to 400 feet high, and they enjoy, or actually neighbors all enjoy, the flashing lights that now are on top. They all flash in unison, so there's 450 lights flashing at one time across God knows how many square miles. Is that your? Can we blame you for that, or are you going to do some rules that address these kinds of issues?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vince, you can't blame me for that, and I'd be happy to.
I think he wants.
That's in the context of
unison.
That would be in the context of the.
He's like a strobe.
Yeah, in all seriousness, the question is, who is responsible for the requirement that those lights be on those 400-foot machines? And to whom do folks who are concerned address their, well, I won't say anger, but certainly heightened level of concern over their environment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, I do have authority to hold a public hearing and determine adequate marking and lighting standards for those structures and then petition the FAA. That was under FAA jurisdiction, so the who is FAA, the fix-it person, I can play a role in that.
Good. Thank you very much.
All righty. Seeing no more questions, thank you, Mr. Clem. I have Ken Niles and Bob Hall as well to testify. If you don't mind talking together?
No.
Or next to each other?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Ken Niles. I'm an assistant director at the Oregon Department of Energy, and I am here simply to offer our support of the endorsement or the amendment, rather, -8. It simply clarifies the already existing authority of the Oregon Energy Facility Siting Council. There are already very strict rules in terms of the siting of wind turbines. That's provided through the Energy Facility Siting Council. So the large projects right now at this point are already captured within the requirements of the Energy Facility Siting Council.
Mr. Hall, please.
Thank you. Representative Cole, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Robert Hall, and I'm here today representing PGE. I'd just like to add our support for Senate Bill 171 as amended, or to include the -8 amendments. The FSEC, Energy Facilities Siting Council, has done an excellent job of regulating energy facilities, and we've added the name of the FSEC into the specific notifications. So we think this is a good bill if it's amended by the -8 amendments. And if I could speak for myself for a moment, as an active pilot for little airplanes, if I saw any safety concerns in here at all, you would hear them. I think it's a good bill with the amendments that I would we would support it.
Great. Any questions? Representative Schaffler?
And Bob's my constituent. I'm sure I would have heard about it.
Thank you, Representative Schaffler.
any other comments or questions? All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
With that, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 171A and open a work session. And I'm looking for a motion. Representative Berger.
We move the amendments?
We do move, yes, please.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the 8 amendments to Senate Bill 171A.
Are there any objections? Oh, do I say what you said? Mm-hmm. Representative Berger has moved the A8 amendments to Senate Bill 171.
Yes, sir.
And
good job.
There are no objections? Okay, so we've adopted the A8 amendments, correct?
Yes.
Representative Berger?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move Senate Bill 171A as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation from the committee.
Representative Berger moves Senate Bill 171 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is that a... That wasn't...
No,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
Is there any objection? Okay. It's adopted. Carrier. Who wants to carry this?
I think that Representative Gilman.
Gilman?
Carry the bill?
Yes, Representative Gilman will carry the bill.
Okay.
And with that, we'll close the work session and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 170. Yes, please, Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 170A expands from four to six the number of airports eligible to participate in the Department of Aviation's Through the Fence pilot project. It revised the definition of rural airport for purposes of conditions used to determine eligibility for the pilot project. In your packets, you have the Dash A2 amendment. That amendment makes a technical wording fix in Section 1, Sub 1. There was some words transposed. The department found that and asked for an amendment to just make a very technical change. Doesn't affect the bill at all. It just makes it work the way it's supposed to.
Great. Wow.
Oh, if I should mention, Mr. Chair, you do have a notice of no revenue impact on the Dash 2s and also the big one-page white fiscal impact statement that says a lot of words to that reach a conclusion of minimal fiscal impact. So although it's a full page of commentary, the impact is minimal on the Dash 18.
Mr. Chair. All righty. And with that, Dan Clem for the third time.
Mr. Chair, members of the House Committee on Transportation, still Dan Clem, Director of Oregon Department of Aviation. Pleased to bring this bill to expand a pilot program started in 2005 under Senate Bill 680. The airports can be, particularly for rural Oregon and those without control towers, which by definition are non-commercial airports. So for the non-commercial rural airports, the Through the Fence program can really be another tool in the kit box of communities to try to create jobs and economic development. As you saw, Columbia Helicopter has provided a tremendous anchor over time and without legislation, obviously, at the Aurora State Airport. But what it's done for us at the Aurora Airport is it's provided us a framework for how we regulate folks, how they're charged fees within the fence, and how they're charged fees if they are off airport and want to come through the fence. So it's what the FAA calls a through the fence program. Through the fence is problematic if it isn't properly regulated. Are those coming through the fence pay their fair share of the tenants on the airport who lease or pay fuel flowage fees? Are they paying their fair share? And what we've struck in Oregon is a pilot program that many other states are watching, as well as the FAA, in determining whether or not, if it's properly regulated, you can make sure that your airport not only stays in its primary role as a public right-of-way, but also that it provides an opportunity for the community to quite frankly, put their arms around and enjoy their airport. Many airports have through-the-fence operations. The Hertz Rent-A-Car out here at the Salem Airport is an example of a through-the-fence operation. He's not in the airport boundary, but they have needs sometimes for airport access. So many of the airports already have through the fence. What we've done in Oregon with the pilot program is establish the Aurora State Airport, Scappoose Industrial Airport, and City of Baker Municipal Airport as pilot airports. Over the last year or so, we've conducted working group meetings to figure out How do we make changes to this? How do we make it better? How do we create conditions that provide more opportunity to attract businesses? How do we become shovel ready so that if a business outside the airport wants to pay some access fees to use the airport to create jobs and move cargo, for example, how do we set that up? And through the process of three working group meetings over the last year, we essentially landed on a couple of things that we would do within the administrative rules, but one of those things instead statute is maybe to expand it to see where each airport's different, and so you can't have a one rule fits all. And so we went out and told other airports that we were thinking about expanding the program, and three of them indicated that they'd have an interest. So this bill comes to you from the Department of Aviation and the Oregon Aviation Board to continue the pilot program with another three airports. It doesn't take any funds
It doesn't encumber the local jurisdiction or municipality with funds. It creates a little more work. But in fact, the best benefit at the Aurora State Airport is the fact that we have a public-private partnership. We meet once a month. All of the land use jurisdictions are represented, as well as the tenants, as well as the commercial operators, both in the fence and outside the fence. And they all essentially help the Oregon Department of Aviation make cogent decisions about how the airport is operated, the fees that are charged there, and so forth. For example, at the Aurora State Airport, all of the lit signs on all four corners of that airport that borders Clackamas County and Marion County, all of those were paid for by the tenants. A lot of the improvements to paving and to facilities that the public can use when they fly in or they hold events there are essentially levied by a vote of how we do it with how the Oregon Department of Aviation does it with the tenants. There are a number of people who support this bill that really had asked me to come forward and look at changing the name of it to the Airport Public-Private Partnership Bill for Airports, because it really does help resolve some of those issues by allowing everybody to enjoy decision-making on the airport. In the bill, we've redefined rural airport, and we've changed the number from, we're asking you to change the number from 75,000 to 500,000. There may be some concern about that, but one of the communities that stepped forward and said, look, we're interested in the program, is the Bend Municipal Airport, which does not have a control tower. They had indicated some interest in it, as well as Brookings, and as well as the Grant Regional Airport at John Day. So again, the program is alive and well in Baker, Scappoose, and at Aurora, and three other communities would like the opportunity to take a look at providing a structured, regulated way of promoting business on the airport so that it's equitable for folks on the airport as well as off the airport. We've seen more increased economic activity at the Aurora Airport as a result of this collaboration and these through-the-fence opportunities. I went past my comment about the rural airport definition of 75,000. We chose the number 500,000 because under a standard metropolitan statistical area with a population of, we weren't sure if Bend exceeded maybe 250,000 or was under it. So quite frankly, we chose the number 500,000, which would essentially include every airport in Oregon that didn't have a tower that wasn't Portland. So essentially, we wanted to make it available. We didn't want to limit it by a number to just only those that hit a certain number. Essentially, Portland wouldn't be interested. They're already a commercial airport. So we didn't want to distinguish or discriminate against any other airport that may want to apply for the program. What's required? They provide an annual report. They take part in the working group meetings, and we provide the information and lessons learned that we've learned at the other three airports with them so that they can establish an orderly, structured method for using the airport to promote economic activity. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Representative Berger. Yeah, Dan, you've in some sense oversold here. What's the downside of not having of through the fence? Is it the lack of regulation that the state has to give up, control of the space around it? I mean, there isn't one.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, there isn't any. It's voluntary. It's, do you want to set up a structure for your tenants to play and your community to play a role in your airport, both on airport and off airport? There's no doubt. If a community doesn't want to do it, they may risk just the lack of what we've learned and the structure in involving all those.
Well, and you're not understanding my question. Why wasn't this done years ago? Why has the structure been built with the fence that we're now opening?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, thank you for the clarification. The FAA is not crazy about through the fence.
Short answer.
There have been airports who have allowed outside of the airport users through the fence without making sure that there was equitable payment. Everybody's got to pay for the airport, off airport, on airport. And FAA dissuades through the fence operations. We started in 2005 with good vision to say, look, if you do it right, you involve tenants and communities in how that airport operates, what it becomes in growth and development, or quite frankly, mostly small rural airports in your jurisdictions are having a hard time trying to keep the airport open.
And so we play a role in that in providing advice. But the downside is there could be opportunities where there's not equity.
Representative Widener?
Thank you. Dan, I don't know if you're familiar with the McMinnville Municipal Airport, but don't we have through the fence there going with Evergreen and the positive with the new runway and everything that they did there at the airport?
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, yes, it has a control tower, and in fact, it's under a different set of rules. Through the fence operations are governed in FAA regulations in that regard. So McMinnville would not be subject to this. This is really meant for non-control towered airports. So they are regulated under FAA. It's all of the small rural airports that don't have towers that we're trying to provide a structure for.
Follow up. So McMinnville, because they do have a through-the-fence operation in McMinnville.
Yes, they do. It
with the FAA. With the FAA.
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, they've done it with the airport sponsor. I believe it's the city of McMinnville. And they've done it in a structure that the FAA has inspected and likely approved.
Okay. Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. This is kind of unrelated, but not really. The Port of Portland consists of the seagoing port and the airport. Are there any other examples like that where the port authority also does the airport in Oregon? Or is that the only one?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, there are several others. The port also operates the Hillsborough Airport and the Troutdale Airport.
No, forgive me. Not the Port of Portland.
Okay.
Is there another port authority that does the airport and the seagoing Mariner port?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, I believe that the Coos County Airport District was formed but recently to separate it from the seagoing. But previous to that, that port had managed both seagoing and air, as well as currently the Port of Astoria manages the Astoria Airport and seagoing operations. So I'm aware of those two. I understand that the Scappoose Industrial Airport is managed by the Port of St. Helens, and I believe they also have marine.
All right, thank you.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dan, Aurora is going to get a tower pretty soon. What happens to its status through the fence at that time?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman, it goes under the same rules that the McMinnville Airport does. It falls under a specific set of FAA regulations that requires a whole different level of scrutiny and rule following. So it becomes like McMinnville at that time.
Representative Pence?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I understand this correctly, the idea is that the boundary of the airport would be expanded to include properties that are adjacent to whatever the boundary is now, which then can you take your aircraft and move onto the runway? Is that a way of saying it? Since the airport boundary, I'm just looking at the section one, airport boundary includes the combined public and private properties that are permitted to have direct access to aircraft by the airport runway, and I couldn't quite figure out what that last phrase meant. Access to aircraft by the airport runway.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, that's the reason for the A2 amendment. The words are backwards. Access to the runway by the aircraft is the way it should read.
Okay. Can I follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
A little embarrassing there. But
well, that's all right. But the point is, if you have a hangar that's apparently the boundary is going to be established by the hangar that's furthest away, and as you taxi your plane from the hangar to the runway, I guess you're crossing property that would now be included within the airport boundary. So is that the idea of the bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, that's correct.
And then the further idea, the bill says everything but tax. It doesn't say it. It says cooperate, coordinate, contract, get together, talk, party, everything, but it doesn't say a word about tax. And so the question is the expansion of the boundaries is to draw people together, but I'm not quite sure how. Does it give the airport FBO authority then to charge fees, or what is it that would want, encourage people to want to be included in this boundary expansion exercise we're engaging in with this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, that is a very good question, and the reality of it is the airport boundary with regard to this bill would expand, but the technical issue is that I have to, if it's the Aurora Airport, I have to amend the airport layout plan and have to have FAA approval, and there's a public process involved in that. So for purposes of this bill, that property would be wrapped up into the airport boundary, but I would first have to go through an administrative process to do that. So the word tax doesn't change here at all, and the FBO doesn't have any authority over any property. The FBO has the responsibility to provide aeronautical services, but it doesn't change the authority piece or the taxation piece.
The question, I guess, is I shouldn't say FBO. Whoever the owner or controller of the airport is, that group would be the group that's most interested in expanding the circle of folks who are responsible for all the stuff that needs to go on. And so I'm just curious if this is opening the door to that expansion. Is this a first step in allowing that to happen? Or is this a... Because I see two things happening. One is the opportunity for further economic development, maybe involving the very properties we're talking about. And that's good. But the other piece of it is, it's clear from the bill, that they're trying to gather more folks to help pay the cost of running the airport. That's probably good, too, because they're using it. But I'm just curious about the machinery that's then used to actually get people to pay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, this is even the property owner who wants through the fence access has to make application to the airport sponsor and agree to abide by the minimum standards and all the conditions that those on the airport agree to, paying access, paying fuel flowage fee. So now comes that word tax. If there's in fact a fuel flowage fee for pumping of fuel on the airport boundary, it would now extend to that property. Not a tax, it's a self-imposed fee. But they make a voluntary application to receive permission to go through the fence, and they abide by the standards, and they sign an access agreement, just like everybody else on the airport. So you're absolutely right. It makes them part of the airport operationally.
Thank you very much.
All righty, thank you, Mr. Clem. Art Schlack.
Thank you. Vice Chair Call, members of the committee, my name is Art Schlack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. We support the expansion of the number of pilot airports that this bill provides. However, we are concerned with the change in the number of 75,000 to 500,000 at this point. We are concerned that the change in the number, in this number, may... instead of serving rural Oregon, do more than that. And we're concerned that we need to, the purpose of this provision and statute and opportunity is to help rural Oregon. If I was to ask you if if you're an Oregonian, you look at a population of 500,000, if that's rural, I don't think I'd get too many of you saying, yep, that's rural. In California, it might be, but it isn't in Oregon. 75,000 has been a number that has been functional since this bill was put into place, and I can't think of too many places in Oregon that I would say is rural that is in excess of 75,000 at this point. So we would like the opportunity to do a little more research with respect to the number, the appropriateness of adjusting the number, beg your indulgence not to move the bill today, but to allow us the opportunity to do that and to bring further information or an amendment to you later this week, if that's appropriate, or whenever you would like to see that. But we would support the bill as it is drafted, with the deletion of the 500,000 at this point. One other comment and had to do with a question about that Representative Berger raised. The only other concern that we would have, and it's not something that has manifested itself at this point, is the concern that counties would have about land use as it relates to adjacent airports and private property, and whether this puts pressure to convert land around airports, let's say, from natural resource uses to other uses at this point. This has not been a problem to date at this point, but it's something that is a possibility.
Representative Berger?
Thank you. Art, this bill came out of the Senate. Did you raise these issues in the Senate?
They were discussed, but they were not, I guess, were not fully vetted at that time.
Discussed by you?
We were involved in discussions with Senate Bill 170 and 171.
Over these issues?
Over a number of issues at this point, and we are, 171 was something that there was questions about the number here and why. And, you know, the response at this point has not been something that we're comfortable with.
Have you... I guess we're getting real late here, and I guess...
I appreciate that.
You're raising some sort of issue flags, but I don't see where you're going with them particularly. They're more like little things like this than I'm not sure how to respond. I see where you're going with rural, but I think it was sort of explained where they're going with rural, which is Bend, in these numbers, describing a rural airport. I'm just not sure why the counties... I'm not clear what exactly you're getting at as the downside here, and maybe that's just me. That at this late date, this is without an amendment to change anything.
Vice Chair Call, Representative Berger, it has been an issue that's been raised. I apologize for not having an amendment here before you today. And I think, you know, our intent, again, is to ensure that through the fence under these provisions primarily are intended to support rural airports at this point, and we continue to have that concern.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this might get to an issue that Representative Schaffler was dealing with earlier, and because I could see this spurring economic development outside the fence and people building hangars and being able to run them in. But they could start building them in wetlands where geese would tend to land, and this way we could keep them away from the airports and the planes would be safe. So I don't know where you have the issue with $500,000, but I can see this as an opportunity for cities and counties that have these airports for developing hangars outside the fence for kind of bringing growth to the counties.
Chair Call, Representative Widener, we support development consistent with the county's comprehensive plan, and we support where somebody can have a residential dwelling and an airport hangar and having access, being able to do that. The only concern that we would have, as I mentioned, about land use is when it would put pressure to convert land from let's say a natural resource area or where you could do a dwelling to an industrial use that, you know, would require a comprehensive plan amendment and those kinds of things. And that's the long-term, shall we say, concern. But I just expressed that because Representative Berger asked the question about, well, long-term, big picture, you know, what might be the downside. And
Representative Schaffler?
If they're going to create jobs, Representative, I don't care if it's EFU land, wetland, forest land, anything. But, you know, Representative Jensen, when I had the honor of serving with him when he was chair of the Water Committee, he would frequently say, there's always next session. And then my good friend Alan Brown, Representative Brown, when he was chair of the Business, Labor, Consumer Affairs Committee, which I had the honor of serving on, said, there's a time to talk and there's a time to vote. Mr. Chair, I think it's time to vote. I don't know what your instructions were left by the chair, but if you're willing, I'm ready to vote on this bill right now today.
Well, I do hope we get there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Art. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
But just to be very clear, it is my intent to close the public hearing, open a work session. I have told Chair Byer that I'm going to try to clear the docket for her. So unless there's some real objections, then I'll carry the bill over. So here's your chance before I hit the gavel. So public hearing is closed and open a work session on Senate Bill 170. And I'd entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Don't forget.
I move the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 170A.
Representative Berger moves the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 170. Any objections? The amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 170A as adopted to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Berger moves Senate Bill 170A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Might as well call the roll on this one. Clerk.
You can ask if there's discussion.
Is there a discussion? Sorry. Oh, wow.
Time to vote.
Yeah. Call the roll.
Representative
Bailey. Aye.
Representative Benz.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Representative Boone.
Aye.
Representative Edwards.
Aye.
Representative Schaffler.
Aye.
Representative
Wagner. Aye.
Representative Gilman?
Aye.
Representative
Hall? Aye. I guess that was unnecessary. The motion is adopted. Is there a carrier? Anybody? George has already got one. Representative Bailey will carry the bill.
Okay, I'll take that one too.
Okay. Representative Gilman will take that one too. With that, I close the work session, and we are adjourned.